A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I spent years of my childhood lying awake in bed, listening for footsteps. Not because I was afraid of monsters. I was listening to make sure everyone else was safe. And I kept doing it long after I left that house, long after my father was gone. I'd be in my own apartment, 30 years old, and I'd catch myself listening. I couldn't have told you. So when Daniel sent us this prompt about the Children of Alcoholics movement, it landed. He grew up with an alcoholic father who later died from his illness. He never struggled with alcohol himself, so when he first heard about COA groups, he wondered what the point was, especially when the alcoholic wasn't even in his life anymore. But he started noticing things. The inability to invite friends over because you never knew what you'd walk into. And he's asking, what is this movement actually about, beyond the assumption that it's just about preventing inherited addiction? And what do people actually get from it?
That's the question that most people get wrong about this movement, and I say that as someone who got it wrong for a long time, too. The Children of Alcoholics movement, and we're talking specifically about organizations like Adult Children of Alcoholics, founded in 1978. It's not primarily about preventing you from becoming an alcoholic. That's what people assume, and it makes sense that they assume it. But the actual focus is on something much deeper.
What is it, then? Because the name does sort of point in one direction.
And that's been a branding problem for decades. What it actually addresses is the developmental trauma of growing up in an unpredictable, shame-bound family system. The addiction is the thing that created the environment, but the damage that needs healing isn't about the substance, it's about the architecture of your childhood, the habits you built to survive that house, the rules you learned about what you were and weren't allowed to feel.
That's a useful distinction. The alcohol was the earthquake, but the groups are about repairing the foundation.
This didn't come out of nowhere. The movement really crystallized around the work of Dr. Doctor. Claudia Black, who published a book in 1981 called It Will Never Happen to Me. It sold over 2 million copies and is still considered the foundational text. She was one of the first people to say, we've been studying the alcoholic, but what about the children? What about the people who grew up in those homes and are now adults? Walking around with a whole set of survival strategies they don't even recognize as strategies.
That's the shift. The prompt mentions not struggling with alcohol. Enjoying red wine in moderation, actually. So the surface level assumption would be, you dodge the bullet, you're fine. But the question Daniel's really asking is why he still felt, decades later, like he had to keep secrets about completely ordinary things. Why he couldn't shake the vigilance.
That's where we need to start with the neurobiology, because it's not just a feeling. When you grow up in a chronically unpredictable environment, and this is what the research from NACOA, the National Association for Children of Alcoholics, has been documenting for years, your brain's threat detection system gets rewired. We're talking about the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, the HPI axis. These are not metaphors. These are physical systems that get calibrated in childhood based on what the environment tells them to expect.
Walk me through that. What actually happens?
The amygdala is your brain's alarm system. It scans for threats and triggers the stress response. In a stable home, a child's amygdala learns, most things are safe, threat is the exception. But in an alcoholic home, the threat signal is unreliable. Dad might be fine at dinner and raging by 8 o'clock. The house might be calm when you go to sleep and a war zone when you wake up. So the amygdala adapts by staying on high alert all the time. It can't afford to miss a signal because missing a signal might mean getting hurt.
It's like a smoke detector that's been set to go off at the faintest whiff of toast.
That's exactly the analogy. And the prefrontal cortex, which normally helps regulate that fear response, saying, we've seen this before, it's not actually dangerous. That system gets impaired. The HPI axis, your body's stress hormone cascade, becomes dysregulated. Cortisol levels get chronically elevated. And here's the crucial part, these changes persist. They don't just reset when you turn 18 and move out. The brain built itself around the assumption that the world is unpredictable and dangerous, and it doesn't automatically update that assumption just because the dangerous person is gone.
This explains why I was still listening for footsteps in my 30s. My brain had been trained to do that. It wasn't a choice I was making.
It wasn't a choice. It was a physiological adaptation. And that's one of the most liberating things people discover when they engage with the COA framework, that these behaviors aren't character flaws or moral failings. They're survival strategies that outlived their usefulness.
Let's talk about those strategies. The prompt mentioned secrecy, vigilance, not being able to invite friends over. Those feel like they belong to a larger pattern.
They absolutely do. And this is where Dr. Claudia Black's work was so groundbreaking. She codified what she called the three unspoken rules of alcoholic families: don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. These rules aren't posted on the refrigerator, nobody says them out loud, but every child in that household absorbs them.
Let's take them one at a time. Don't talk.
Don't talk means don't talk about what's happening in this house. Don't tell anyone that Dad drinks. Don't tell anyone about the fight last night. Don't tell anyone how you really feel. And this becomes so deeply ingrained that it extends to everything. You become secretive about things that don't even need to be secrets. The prompt mentions this, the lifelong habit of secrecy, the work of undoing it. That's textbook, don't talk. You learned that talking was dangerous, so you stopped talking. And that habit doesn't discriminate between dangerous secrets and completely benign information.
I remember not being able to tell people the most mundane things. What I did over the weekend. Why I seemed tired. It felt like any information could be weaponized.
Because in that environment, it could be. You learned that information was dangerous, so you hoarded it. And then there's don't trust. When your primary caregiver is unpredictable, when the person who's supposed to keep you safe is also the source of fear, you learn that trust is a liability. You can't trust what they say because they might not remember saying it. You can trust promises because they'll be broken. You can trust that love is stable because it can flip to rage without warning.
That follows you into adult relationships.
And then don't feel. This might be the most devastating one because it cuts you off from your own internal signals. In an alcoholic home, expressing your feelings might provoke the volatile parent. Being sad might trigger rage. Being happy might be seen as not taking the situation seriously. So you learn to numb, and decades later you're an adult who genuinely can't identify what you're feeling. You might have a vague sense of discomfort and not know whether it's sadness, anger, fear, or loneliness.
That's the one that took me the longest to recognize in myself. I thought I was just a calm person. No, I was a person who had learned that feelings were dangerous and had gotten very good at not having them.
That's exactly the kind of revelation that happens when people encounter the ACA framework. Which brings us to something really practical, the laundry list.
The what now?
The laundry list. It's a term from Adult Children of Alcoholics literature, a list of 14 common characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, first published in 1981 and revised most recently in 2006. It's publicly available, free, and one of the most powerful self-assessment tools I've ever seen. Let me walk through a few of them because they map directly onto what we've been discussing. Number one, we became isolated and afraid of people and authority figures. That's the don't trust rule manifesting. Number two, we became approval seekers and lost our identity in the process. That's the fawn response, managing everyone's emotions to stay safe. Number three, we are frightened by angry people and any personal criticism. Because anger in the childhood home wasn't just displeasure, it was a threat. Number four, we either become alcoholics, marry them, or both, or find another compulsive personality such as a workaholic to fulfill our sick abandonment needs. That's the repetition compulsion. We gravitate toward what's familiar, even if what's familiar is chaos.
There's one on the list that always gets me. We have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, and it is easier for us to be concerned with others rather than ourselves.
That's number 12. And it's so common. When you grew up managing an alcoholic parent's emotions, you learned that your job was to keep the peace, to anticipate needs, to prevent explosions. You become the family's emotional thermostat. And as an adult, you walk into every room and immediately start scanning who's upset, who needs managing, what do I need to do to keep this situation stable? You're so busy monitoring everyone else that you have no idea what you yourself need.
That connects back to the hypervigilance. You're not just scanning for physical threats, you're scanning for emotional ones.
And the laundry list has another item that's particularly relevant. We guess at what normal behavior is. A COA might constantly ask their partner or colleagues, "Is this okay? Am I doing this right?" Because they never had a stable baseline for healthy interaction. They don't know what a normal disagreement looks like, because disagreements in their home were terrifying. They don't know what normal affection looks like, because affection was conditional. They're navigating adult life without a map, and they assume everyone else has one.
That's a devastating phrase, guessing at what normal is. I've spent so much of my life doing exactly that. Watching other people to figure out how I'm supposed to react, what I'm supposed to feel, whether something is a big deal or not.
Here's the thing the movement really emphasizes. This isn't a personal failing. You weren't born missing the normal gene. You were raised in an environment where normal wasn't available. The map you built of how relationships work, how emotions work, how trust works, it was built in a war zone. Of course, it's not going to serve you well in peacetime.
Let me pull on a thread from earlier. The prompt specifically asks, why would someone whose alcoholic parent is no longer in their life still benefit from a support group? I think we've established that the patterns persist, but let's make it explicit.
The alcoholic parent is, in a sense, beside the point. The damage wasn't done by the alcohol. It was done by the environment the alcohol created. The emotional neglect. The parent might be dead, estranged, sober for 20 years. Those things are all good, but they don't automatically undo the neural wiring. The hypervigilance doesn't get a memo that says, "Threat resolved, you can stand down now." The secrecy habit doesn't evaporate because there's no longer anyone to keep secrets from. The difficulty with trust doesn't disappear because the untrustworthy person is gone. If anything, it generalizes to everyone else.
Because you learned that people are untrustworthy, not just that one person.
The COA movement is not about the alcoholic, it's about the family system. It's about the child who adapted to that system and is now an adult, walking around with adaptations that no longer serve them.
Let's get into what that looks like in adult life. You mentioned relationships earlier.
This is where attachment theory becomes really useful. Children of alcoholics very often develop what's called disorganized attachment or anxious, preoccupied attachment. Disorganized attachment happens when the caregiver is both a source of comfort and a source of fear. The child is trapped in an impossible bind. They need the parent for survival, but the parent is also the threat. There's no coherent strategy for managing that, so the attachment system breaks down into contradictory behaviors.
That shows up in adult romantic relationships. How?
In a few predictable patterns. One is chasing unavailable partners, people who are emotionally distant, inconsistent, or otherwise incapable of providing secure attachment. It's not that COAs consciously choose unavailable people. It's that availability feels unfamiliar and therefore unsafe. Secure, consistent love doesn't register as love. It registers as something suspicious. Another pattern is difficulty with emotional regulation during conflicts. A minor disagreement with a partner can trigger a full-body threat response because conflict in the childhood home was dangerous. The nervous system can't tell the difference between "we disagree about where to go for dinner" and "someone's about to get hurt."
I've experienced that. The sense of disproportionate panic over small disagreements. You know intellectually that it's not a big deal, but your body is reacting like the house is on fire.
That's not weakness. That's a conditioned response. Your body learned that conflict equals danger, and it's trying to protect you. The problem is that the protection is now causing harm. Another adult pattern, the deep-seated belief that love is conditional or unpredictable. If your parents' love could disappear at any moment, depending on their intoxication level, their mood, factors you couldn't control, you learn that love is not something you can count on. You might become hypervigilant in relationships, constantly testing whether your partner really loves you, constantly bracing for abandonment.
Or you might preemptively push people away, because leaving feels safer than being left.
That's the don't trust rule in action. If you don't let anyone in, nobody can hurt you. It's a strategy that worked in childhood, but it's devastating in adult relationships, where trust is the foundation of intimacy.
What about career and work life? I feel like these patterns don't stay neatly contained in the personal sphere.
They absolutely bleed into everything. The approval-seeking behavior, the overdeveloped sense of responsibility, the difficulty with criticism, these show up constantly in professional settings. A COA might be the person who can't say no, who takes on everyone else's work, who panics at the faintest hint of negative feedback. They might be terrible at advocating for themselves in salary negotiations because they learned that asking for things was dangerous. They might be the office peacekeeper, managing everyone's emotions because that's the role they were trained for.
The laundry list item about difficulty following projects through. That one surprised me when I first encountered it. What's the connection?
The ACA literature suggests this comes from a combination of factors. One is the chaos of the childhood environment. You never learned how to plan and execute because the environment was too unpredictable for planning to be useful. Another is the internal critic. COAs tend to judge themselves extremely harshly, and that perfectionism can be paralyzing. If you're terrified of doing something imperfectly, starting and finishing projects becomes emotionally exhausting. You abandon things because finishing them means exposing them to judgment, your own and others.
That connects to another laundry list item. We lie when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. That one's uncomfortable to sit with.
And it's not about being a dishonest person. It's about the don't talk rule being so deeply internalized that your default response to any question is to deflect, minimize, or fabricate. You learned that the truth was dangerous, that telling the truth about what was happening at home could bring shame, could trigger consequences. So you developed a reflexive habit of not telling the truth, even about things where the truth would be completely fine.
I've caught myself doing this. Someone asks what I did over the weekend, and I'll say, not much, when I actually had a perfectly normal, pleasant weekend. There's no reason to hide it, but the reflex is still there.
That's the thing the movement helps people understand. These are reflexes, not character. You're not a liar. You're someone who learned that speech was dangerous and developed a protective reflex. Naming that, understanding where it came from, is the first step toward changing it.
We've mapped out the problem pretty thoroughly. Let's talk about what these groups actually do. How does ACA work, practically speaking?
ACA uses an adapted 12-step framework, but it's important to understand how it differs from something like Alcoholics Anonymous. In AA, the 12 steps are about addressing your relationship with alcohol and making amends for harms caused. In ACA, the steps are focused on what the literature calls reparenting, rebuilding the internal structures that were damaged or never developed in childhood. The first step in ACA is, we admitted we were powerless over the effects of alcoholism or other family dysfunction, that our lives had become unmanageable. Notice the language, powerless over the effects, not powerless over alcohol.
That's a crucial distinction. You're not admitting powerlessness over a substance you may not even use. You're admitting that the effects of growing up in that environment have made your life unmanageable.
And the meetings themselves provide what psychologists call a corrective emotional experience. You're in a room or on a Zoom call with people who share your weird normal. You don't have to explain why you can't invite people to your house. You don't have to justify why you're still upset about something that happened 30 years ago. The don't talk rule gets broken, safely, in a space where talking is the whole point.
You're learning to break the other rules too. Don't trust. You're in a group where people are vulnerable with each other, and that vulnerability isn't weaponized. Don't feel. The meetings explicitly encourage emotional expression. People cry in ACA meetings. They get angry. Feelings are allowed.
That's the reparenting piece. You're practicing, in a safe environment, the emotional skills that were never modeled for you. And sponsorship. Having a more experienced member who guides you through the steps provides a kind of mentorship that many COAs never had. A consistent, reliable relationship with someone who's been where you are.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because I think a lot of listeners might be thinking this. Isn't this just group therapy? Why specifically ACA instead of a therapist?
That's a fair question, and the movement is very clear that it's not a replacement for therapy. Many people do both. But ACA provides something that individual therapy often can't, identity affirmation through shared experience. When you're one-on-one with a therapist, they can validate your experience, but they may not share it. In an ACA meeting, you're surrounded by people who don't need you to explain what it's like to lie awake listening for footsteps, because they did it too. There's a particular kind of healing that comes from realizing you're not uniquely broken, that your weird behaviors are actually predictable, shared responses to a specific kind of environment.
That was my experience. I spent decades thinking I was just a weird, secretive, emotionally distant person. And then I sat in a room with people who described my internal life in detail, people I'd never met, and I realized, oh, I'm not weird. I'm just a person who grew up in an alcoholic home. There's a whole taxonomy of this.
That's where the laundry list becomes so powerful. You redo those 14 traits and you check off 12 of them, and suddenly your entire personality makes sense in a new way. It's not that you're flawed. It's that you adapted to a specific environment, and now you're in a different environment, and the adaptations don't fit anymore. The goal isn't to blame your parents. The goal is to understand yourself well enough to change.
Let's address that directly, because there's a misconception that COA groups are about blaming parents or dwelling in victimhood.
The exact opposite, actually. The ACA solution statement, and this is from their official literature, says, the solution is to become your own loving parent. As ACA becomes a safe place for you, you will find freedom to express all the hurts and fears you have kept inside and to free yourself from the shame and blame that are carryovers from the past. You will become an adult who is imprisoned no longer by childhood reactions. The emphasis is on taking responsibility for your own healing. It's forward-looking, not backward-looking.
Become your own loving parent. That's the reparenting concept made explicit.
And it's incredibly practical. The steps involve things like identifying your inner child, the part of you that's still operating from those childhood survival strategies, and learning to respond to that part with compassion rather than contempt. A lot of COAs have a vicious internal critic because criticism was the primary form of feedback they received. Learning to talk to yourself differently is a skill, and ACA provides a framework for developing it.
I want to zoom out for a moment and talk about scale. How big is this movement?
Adult Children of Alcoholics has grown to over 1,200 meetings worldwide across more than 50 countries. And that's just ACA. There's also Al-Anon, which is for family members and partners of alcoholics, and Al-Ateen for teenagers. NACOA, the National Association for Children of Alcoholics, estimates that approximately 1 in 4 children in the United States is exposed to alcohol abuse or dependence in their family before the age of 18. That's a staggering number. We're talking about tens of millions of people.
1 in 4. So if you're not a COA yourself, you almost certainly know several.
And many of them don't identify that way. They might just think they're anxious or bad at relationships or inexplicably secretive. The term adult child of an alcoholic is not intuitive. It sounds like it's describing someone who is both an adult and a child, which is confusing. But that's actually the point. You're an adult, but you're still carrying a child's survival strategies.
Let me ask you about something the prompt raised. The question of fear around alcohol. The prompt says, whatever the research says, I've never felt that having an attitude of fear around alcohol was helpful in any way. And I think that's an important point, because some approaches to COA issues do emphasize abstinence or fear of alcohol.
That's where ACA differs from some other approaches. ACA's primary focus is not on your relationship with alcohol, it's on your relationship with yourself and others. Many ACA members drink moderately or not at all, but it's not a program about substance use. It's a program about the effects of growing up in a dysfunctional family system. The literature explicitly acknowledges that some adult children become alcoholics themselves and some don't, and the program is for both.
That's a relief, honestly, because the fear alcohol approach would have driven me away. I enjoy wine. I don't have a problematic relationship with it. Telling me to be afraid of it would feel like being punished for something I didn't do.
That's a common reaction. Many COAs resist engaging with the movement because they assume it's going to pathologize their relationship with alcohol. When they discover that it's actually about something completely different, about the architecture of their emotional life, that's often the moment when the resistance drops.
Let's get practical. If someone listening to this recognizes themselves in what we've been describing, what should they actually do?
The lowest barrier step is to go to adultchildren.org and read the problem statement and the solution statement. They're short, maybe 5 minutes of reading. They lay out the core framework, then read the laundry list. See how many of the 14 traits resonate. If you're checking off more than a handful, that's a signal that this framework might be useful for you.
If they want to try a meeting,
ACA meetings are free, anonymous, and available both in person and online. You don't have to speak. You can just listen. You don't have to identify yourself as anything. You can attend a few meetings and see if the shared experience lands. There's no commitment, no dues, no membership requirements beyond a desire to heal from the effects of family dysfunction.
One thing I want to emphasize is that this isn't a quick fix. The prompt mentions that undoing secrecy is a work in progress, and I think that's true for most of these patterns. You don't attend 3 meetings and suddenly become a trusting, emotionally expressive person. It's gradual.
It's a process, not an event. And the ACA framework acknowledges that. The steps are meant to be worked repeatedly, at deeper levels. The first time you go through them, you might address the surface-level behaviors. The second time, you might get into the deeper attachment wounds. The third time, you might start to see how the patterns have affected your parenting or your career. It's not about reaching a destination. It's about building the capacity for ongoing growth.
I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier. The prompt mentions that it took a while to understand why this might be necessary. And I think that's worth sitting with, because I had the same experience. The initial reaction is, my parent is gone. I don't have a drinking problem. What's the point? And the answer is so counterintuitive that it takes time to absorb.
The answer is, the problem was never the alcohol. The problem was the environment the alcohol created, and the survival strategies you developed to navigate it. Those strategies are still running, even if the environment has changed. The hypervigilance is still scanning for threats. The secrecy is still protecting you from dangers that no longer exist. The emotional suppression is still numbing you to feelings that are actually safe to feel now.
The group provides something that individual willpower can't. A place to practice being different. You can't think your way out of don't talk. You have to talk, repeatedly, in a safe environment, until your nervous system learns that talking isn't dangerous. You can't think your way out of don't trust. You have to experience trustworthiness, repeatedly, until your brain updates its model of what relationships can be.
That's the corrective emotional experience, and it's why peer support groups can be so effective for this particular kind of healing. It's not about acquiring information, it's about having experiences that contradict the lessons of childhood.
Let me ask you something that the prompt didn't ask, but that I think is implied. If you grew up in a household that wasn't alcoholic, but was similarly unpredictable, maybe there was untreated mental illness, or chronic conflict, or a parent who is emotionally volatile for other reasons. Does this framework still apply?
Yes, and ACA has been moving in that direction for years. The full name is Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families. The literature explicitly acknowledges that the same patterns, the unpredictability, the shame, the emotional neglect, can arise from many sources. The alcoholic home is a specific and well-studied case, but the underlying dynamics are broader. The don't talk, don't trust, don't feel rules can operate in any family where emotional honesty is punished and the environment is unpredictable.
We're really talking about a broader phenomenon of developmental trauma from unpredictable, shame-based family systems.
And that connects to the ACEs research. Adverse childhood experiences, which has shown that childhood trauma has dose-dependent effects on physical and mental health across the lifespan. The more adverse experiences you had as a child, the higher your risk for everything from depression to heart disease. Growing up in an alcoholic home is one of the ACEs categories, and it's a significant one.
That's a sobering connection, but it also reinforces the point that this isn't about blame. It's about understanding the actual mechanisms so you can address them effectively.
And I want to be clear about something. The goal is not to erase your childhood or to pretend it didn't happen. The goal is to understand how it shaped you, to have compassion for the child who developed those survival strategies, and to gradually build new strategies that serve you better now. It's not about becoming a different person. It's about becoming a more integrated version of the person you already are.
That's a good place to land. But I want to leave listeners with one more thought. A question I'm still sitting with myself. The COA movement emerged in the 1970s and 80s, and it's grown significantly. But I wonder if we're still in the early stages of understanding this. As awareness of developmental trauma grows, as the ACEs research expands, do we eventually merge the COA framework into a broader understanding of childhood adversity? Or is there something specific about the alcoholic home, the particular flavor of unpredictability, the specific shame dynamics around addiction, that warrants its own dedicated framework?
That's a open question. There are arguments on both sides. The specificity of the alcoholic home does create particular patterns. The laundry list traits are not identical to what you'd see from, say, a child of a narcissistic parent or a child of divorce. But there's also enormous overlap. I suspect the field will move toward integration over time, while preserving the specific insights that the COA movement has developed.
If you're listening and something we've described resonates, the door is open. AdultChildren.org. The laundry list. A meeting, if you're curious. You don't have to identify as anything. You don't have to commit to anything. You can just see if the shared experience lands.
If you're not a COA, but you know someone who might be, understanding this framework can help you be a better friend or partner. Recognizing that the secrecy isn't about you, that the difficulty with trust isn't a personal rejection, that the emotional distance isn't a lack of love. It's the residue of an environment that taught them those things were necessary for survival.
That's the thing I wish more people understood. These behaviors aren't about you. They're about a childhood you weren't present for. And healing is possible, but it's not about willpower or self-help books. It's about finding people who share your weird normal and slowly, together, learning a different way to be. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The ancient Egyptian board game Senet, played as early as 3100 BCE, used game pieces made from faience, a glazed ceramic material composed primarily of crushed quartz, lime, and copper oxide, where the copper was sourced from mines in the eastern desert that would later fall within the borders of modern South Sudan. A connection independently confirmed by a 1954 chemical analysis of game pieces from the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.